Modern circles, the Neanderthals are people like the Jesus Seminar of the 20th century, who thought that science had disproven everything and had found all truth, and the postmoderns look upon ancient man as being acknowledging the mystery to life, and that there's something more to this world, and that we don't have a full grasp on truth because we looked at things in a test tube. So it's really weird. Our media is saying two things right now. Modernism is dead. There is, you know, saying three things. You know, modernism is dead, therefore you can be a reasonable person and believe in a supernatural. But then the media is also saying these radical modernists that make up the Jesus Seminar and deny the supernatural, they're the experts when it comes to Jesus. So, you know, it's just amazing that, but yeah, they still do talk like, you know, these ancient guys are real superstitious and blah, blah, blah. Well, postmodernists believe that the superstitious people are not gullible. They have a better grasp of what's going on than the know-it-all modernist, self-proclaimed know-it-all modernist. So the Jesus Seminar doesn't even see how out of touch they are, you know. So they're a hangover from modernistic thought. So it just, I don't know. It's really weird. But I think it just shows how much, even when all of culture is moving in a direction that favors the supernatural, they're still willing to dig up a few dead modernists if that's what it takes to badmouth Jesus. And so it's kind of like, you know, they'll ridicule modernists and laugh at them, the media will. However, if they badmouth Jesus in that context, these guys will get more media attention than anybody else. But it's kind of, you know, scholars can step out of scholarship anytime they want, and that's what the Jesus Seminar is. It's led by scholars. Some of the guys that are in there have never proven their scholarship, but it's led by scholars. Who are willing to throw the scholarship out the window if need be to say the popular thing, and more times than not the non-scholarly thing. If you look at the orange sheet of paper, got an extra one here. But just looking at the top evidence for Jesus' resurrection. You'd have to go a long way to find a New Testament, one of the world's leading New Testament critics, who denies any of these except the Shroud of Turin. The reason why I put number 12, the Shroud of Turin, with a question mark, the Shroud of Turin, I think, is some of the strongest evidence for Christ's resurrection. Okay? The problem is, let's say you have 3 hours to argue for Christ's resurrection. Well, it probably takes 10 hours to argue for the authenticity of the Shroud of Turin. So it's not going to help your three-hour case. So what I handled the resurrection of Christ as one issue to be dealt with, and the Shroud of Turin is a totally different issue to be dealt with. But once you do make a good, solid case for the Shroud of Turin, then that becomes an added evidence for it. But on the first 11 points, you gotta go a long way to find a New Testament critic who rejects any of these. James has changed life. He was, it's widely recognized based on what Josephus wrote about him, what the New Testament wrote about him. I mean, why fabricate a story that Jesus' own brothers didn't believe he was the Messiah? I mean, wouldn't it kind of make people think, well, wait, why didn't they think he was the Messiah? Maybe there were some secrets that he had that we didn't know about. And, you know, I mean, you're not going to invent premises that can be used as an argument against you. And most New Testament scholars acknowledge that James, the half-brother of Jesus, really did mock Jesus during Jesus' life. They acknowledge that the creed in 1 Corinthians 15:3-8, which names James by name, you know, names him, and then talks about an appearance of Jesus to him, one-on-one, post-resurrection appearance, most acknowledge that that information probably came from James himself, and that his life was transformed to the point where he went from a mocker of Jesus to the leader of the Jerusalem church after Peter fled the Palestine area due to persecution. Well, what changed his life? Some liberal New Testament scholars go so far to say that if James's name was not included in the creed, you would still have a case that James really did believe that he saw Jesus risen from the dead, just based upon the fact that he went from a mocker of Jesus to a leader in the early church almost overnight. It was one of the biggest things they were looking at for apostolic credentials. You had to have seen the resurrected Christ. And so that's acknowledged. Paul's changed life. From the leading persecutor of the Christian church to the leading defender and evangelist of the Christian church. What caused his life to change? Peter's changed life from a guy who denied Jesus three times on the biggest night of his life up to that point to a guy who boldly proclaimed Jesus in public to the point where he was scourged for it, to the point where he was imprisoned for it, and eventually he was crucified upside down for it. The empty tomb, as Craig mentioned, and by the way, Craig gives a list of 44. I could name some other New Testament critics who are world-renowned, but they're probably not on the same level as some of the other guys. I mean, you know, you talk about F.F. Bruce taught at some pretty prestigious European schools, and he's not on that list, the 44. Bruce Metzger, who, you know, is just finishing up his work at Princeton. I mean, there's one of the world's leading New Testament scholars. He's not on that list. And you know, both of those guys, plus about another 20 or 30, I mean, you can build a much bigger list than that, but, you know, Craig's just looking for, you know, he's not even looking at the New Testament scholars who are so world-renowned they write the textbooks. He's looking at the guys, you know, the German theologians leading the, you know, on a cutting edge, and, you know, that their argumentation, I mean, Charlesworth, I don't even think is on that list, and I believe he acknowledges the tomb was found empty. The woman were the first witnesses of the empty tomb. The reason why that's almost universally acknowledged is because a woman's testimony did not hold up in a court of law back then. So if you're going to fabricate a story, you're going to put Peter and John there at the empty tomb. By the way, if you're going to fabricate all this stuff, why have Peter, the guy who's going to lead your early church at the start, why have him even denying Jesus three times? Why have the apostles fleeing? You know? And that's like with Elliot Ratzman. He said, I read the gospel accounts to prepare for this debate, and they obviously they fabricated these stories. And then later on, he said the apostles were a bunch of, why follow these guys? They're presented in their writings as a bunch of bungling idiots. So my response was, you realize what this guy is saying? This guy is saying these guys fabricated these stories, yet portrayed themselves as a bunch of bungling idiots when they were trying to start a new church. I mean, if you're going to fabricate these stories, why make yourself look like an idiot, which is, you know, I mean, let's say you make a new toothpaste and you want to sell this toothpaste. And you make up all kinds of lies about how great this toothpaste is when you really know that it's not, okay? But then you throw in some lies about yourself, or, you know, you're lying about a toothpaste, but then you start telling people that you're a loser. And you've gone bankrupt three or four times.
Then your company like sells drugs.
Yeah. Or your company sold Miracle Wheat and really bombed. It's like you're not going to fabricate. If you're in the business of fabricating, you're not going to fabricate stories that make you look bad when you're trying to start a new work. But the woman is the first witnesses. If that was fabricated, it would have been men and quite possibly the big guns of the apostles. Joseph Arimathea's tomb, we already talked about that. They're not going to make up a lie about a member of the Sanhedrin, you know, the ones that condemned Jesus to death, the ones that were, you know, arresting Peter and John on a regular basis. They're not going to make up a story about one of them. That the apostles died martyrs' deaths. I mean, this is real, real solid church tradition. Reliable sources beyond that verify that the apostles, the leaders of the early church, and their followers were suffering martyrs' deaths. That the apostles believed they saw Jesus alive numerous times, especially the 1 Corinthians 15, 3-8, ancient creed. That the resurrection was preached in Jerusalem. You realize Acts chapters 1 through 12, those sermons are almost universally acknowledged by New Testament critics as authentic sermons preached within 3 to 7 years after Christ's good portion of 3 to 7 years. A few of them go to as far as maybe 42 AD. Yet, in the key point in those messages was that God vindicated Jesus by rising him from the dead. So it's acknowledged, okay, yeah, the resurrection was preached in Jerusalem, and the apostles believed, they really believed they saw Jesus alive numerous times. They were Orthodox Jews, and they changed the worship day from Saturday to Sunday. On Saturday, you gathered based on the Old Testament in honor of God's creation work and resting on the seventh day. Now they change to Sunday. Why? Something as big as or bigger than creation had to occur for Orthodox Jews to do that. The resurrection would fill that billet. I know of nothing else that would. The church grew rapidly in Jerusalem. That's acknowledged as a fact. I mean, Josephus even gives you the percentage of the city that had become Christians. I mean, the growth was enormous. When we talk about the Jews rejecting Christ, it's like, you know, Christ's crucifixion and the persecution of the apostles. And it's that first generation, when you look at the number of the millions of Jews, it's only a small fraction came to Christ, but a very high percentage of that small fraction were in Jerusalem. Because they were right near this stuff. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like Mark said earlier, they were like, okay, Jewish religious leaders, produce the rotting corpse of Christ, because if you can't, I don't know any way to refute what these guys are saying. And we were here for the Passover. We saw it get dark in the middle of the day when this guy was crucified. We heard about and saw how the temple had been torn from top to bottom. We saw the people who were risen from the dead while he was crucified and came around and presented themselves alive to others. We were there for that earthquake. And now we're there 50 days later on the Feast of Pentecost. And Peter's explanation sounds a lot more plausible than anything the Jewish religious leaders are saying right now. When you look at these 11 factors, even apart from the Shroud of Turin, you look at these 11 factors, and there is going to be very little debate. I mean, even if a New Testament, one of the world's leading New Testament critics, wouldn't give you three or four of these, you know, any combination of three or four of these which would be left, or four or five would be left, and you still have a solid case for the resurrection. See, the options that we have, we look again at our notes there, the only four possibilities: either the resurrection accounts, post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, those accounts in the New Testament, either they're legends, or their lies, or the apostles were sincere, but they were deceived somehow, or the apostles were telling the truth. Okay? Now, when we showed New Testament reliability, all we were arguing for was that you cannot push the dates of these writings back to a period of time in which the eyewitnesses were all dead. So basically, while the eyewitnesses were alive and eyewitnesses were leading the church, those writings, the writings we have in the New Testament, were written. So the whole legend hypothesis goes out the window, especially when you get to the ancient creeds, because then you're talking, 1 Corinthians 15, 3-day, you're talking 3 to 7 years after Christ's death. And you already have summary list of the post-resurrection appearances of Christ. But with some of the other creeds, I mean, the latest you can date some of these things are like 40, 50 A.D. So, I mean, there is not time. You don't have the several centuries for legends, for fabrications to overwhelm and overcome core historical data. So the whole idea that it's a legend just does not work. And especially when you try to make legends myths. You know, it's obvious these guys are not writing mythology. I mean, they're telling you what year of the reign of certain kings. I mean, these guys believe they're writing history. And so the legend hypothesis, all those lectures that I gave on New Testament reliability just takes the legend hypothesis and throws it out the window. So now we're only left with either the apostles were lying, or they were deceived, or they were telling the truth. Okay, the apostles were not lying. Now keep in mind this data, that whenever we deal with this, we have to go back to these 11 factors. James, Paul, Peter, their changed lives, the empty tomb, woman, the first witnesses, Joseph of Arimathea's tomb, apostles dying martyrs' deaths, apostles believing they saw Jesus alive numerous times, the resurrection preached in Jerusalem just a few, you know, within a few years of Christ's death, worship day changed to Sunday by Orthodox Jews, church growing rapidly in Jerusalem. You take these factors and then you apply them to trying to answer whether or not the apostles were lying, deceived, or telling the truth. Well, the apostles were not lying. They did not steal the body and fabricate the resurrection accounts, because they claimed that they saw Jesus on numerous occasions, and then they died martyrs' deaths, refusing to deny the resurrection. Men do not die for what they know to be a hoax. Okay? Usually when people lie, they're doing it for some personal gain. Did the apostles, if they fabricated the resurrection accounts, post-resurrection appearances of Christ, those accounts, did that make them wealthier? No. Did that make them popular? No. I mean, all it did was it placed their lives in jeopardy. Okay? Well, that tells us these guys were sincere. They were sincere enough to die for what they believed. Now some people, I've had guys in debate say, well, couldn't you say that about the Muslims that died for the Muslim faith? That they were sincere? You bet they were sincere. But that doesn't give you a resurrection of Muhammad, because that's not even part of the belief system. It doesn't give you anything supernatural. All it shows is Muhammad taught some stuff and these guys bought it. They sincerely believed it. I think a suicide bomber, a suicide hijacker flying into the World Trade, one of the Twin Towers, that's pretty good evidence the guy's sincere in his Islamic beliefs. But you still got a dead Muhammad whose body rotted. Just means that he believed Muhammad's teachings. I'll give him that. He was sincere. But what do you do with the apostles who are sincere enough to die based upon their belief that Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to them numerous times? So basically, they were sincere, so that means you can't call them liars. They really believed that Jesus had risen from the dead and appeared to them alive again. So the conclusion there is the apostles were not liars, They sincerely believed they had seen the resurrected Christ on several occasions. Okay, so now either they were deceived or they were telling the truth. Okay? Well, the apostles were not deceived. The liberal scholars attempted to explain away the resurrection, but then it was the liberal scholars themselves who disproved their own false, their own theories, showed their own theories to be false. The swoon theory in John 19, 31 to 34, that disproves the swoon theory. The swoon theory argued that Jesus didn't really die on the cross. He passed out. They thought he was dead. Took him down from the cross, put him in a cool, damp tomb, rolled the stone over it, and then Jesus revived in the tomb, moved the stone, and presented himself alive. The apostles said, "Wow, you conquered death and all." Several problems with that. Number one, John reports, as an eyewitness, John 19, 31 to 34, that when his side was pierced, see, the Roman soldiers saw Jesus was already dead. See, if you're in a down position, you're not moving, you're dead. Because the only way to breathe is to push off with your feet. If they didn't put that block of wood under the feet of a crucified person, that person would die within minutes. Okay? And so if you have the power to push off, you continue to push off. Well, Jesus was just hanging in the down position. He looked dead. The Roman soldier, rather than breaking his ankle to hasten death and so they could take the bodies off the cross before, off the crosses before the Jewish feast day, he pierced Jesus' side. It was what would have been a lethal blow had he still been alive. But John recorded that what came out appeared to be blood and water. So you have blood and then you have a transparent liquidy substance alongside it. Well, now modern medical science has shown that that only occurs, there's only two causes for that. But either case, either way, the body is a corpse. It's either a rupture of the heart or death by asphyxiation. But in both, and which are both, by the way, consistent with crucifixion, but in both cases, death has to occur. The heart has to be in such a state that that phenomenon would occur. Now, medical science did not know that when John was reporting it. John, it appears that John reported that because in the Old Testament he saw blood everywhere and all the old animal sacrifices. And he saw, and then the idea that we're cleansed through blood, through the sprinkling of blood and the shedding of animal bloodshed, but also ceremonial cleansing with water. So it seems that he saw in the blood and the water a fulfillment of the Old Testament cleansing with blood and with water, and so he mentions it. And he mentions, he mentions it in such a way that it's like, hey, I don't want to be mistaken here. I'm telling you the truth. I saw blood and water come out. And he acts like he had never seen that before because he probably never seen somebody who died from either heart rupture or asphyxiation whose then body was punctured in that portion of his body after death. I mean, this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing that he saw there. And so it was unusual to him, and he thought maybe it's some connection with the Old Testament, blood and water. He records it, but the fact of the matter is now 2,000 years later, we know medical science has shown that that only happens to a dead person. Well, let's just throw out medical science here and just assume, okay, let's assume that he did pass out on the cross. Well, the fact of the matter is if you're in a down position, you're as good as dead, but let's just assume that he came down from the cross alive, okay? He was scourged. He was crucified for 6 hours, on the cross for 6 hours. Hey, if they're going to put him in a cool, damp tomb for several days, if he's not dead, he's got, he's probably, from the Roman flagrum, the Roman scourging, he's probably got some bones exposed, chunks of meat just ripped, torn right off his body. Infection is going to set in a cool, damp, dark tomb. He's probably going to die while in the tomb anyway. Okay? But let's assume, no, that's not what happens. How in the world does a weak, battered, beaten, nearly dead man, let alone a Lou Ferrigno kind of guy, last without the food but then move the stone from the inside? I mean, it just takes a wimp to roll a stone over a tomb, to block the opening of a tomb. Because you got Mr. Gravity, it works with you. You roll the tomb, you just push it, and this several ton stone rolls down. But when Mr. Gravity is working against you and you're trying to push it up, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes it's easy to, you know, it's really to push a car down a hill, but if the hill is steep enough, you could be Lou Ferrigno, you're not going to push that car up it. And the way these were set up with the two, you know, and cars have wheels, and you could put them in neutral. With a stone, you just got the stone. And so it's just one big wheel, and it's not perfectly smooth, and then it weighs several tons, and then if you got to go uphill, it's going to take several strong men to move it. So if it takes several strong men from the outside where they can get their hands behind it, what do you do from the inside? There's nothing to grab. So, I mean, Lou Ferrigno from the inside, a healthy Lou Ferrigno couldn't. How is a guy who's close to death going to be able to move it? The other factor is you can make a very strong case that there were Roman soldiers at the tomb. That the apostles, if they had fabricated that story, the Jewish religious leaders would have disproven it. They would have gotten the Roman authorities, they'd have pressured the Pilate, the Roman authorities, to tell everybody, okay, there were not Roman soldiers at the tomb. And the apostles would have probably either been taken out and stoned, or would have just been ridiculed as a bunch of buffoons spinning tails. So now he's got to overpower the Roman guards. Then he's got to walk around miles, when you look at all his different resurrection and post-resurrection appearances, walking around on feet with holes in them and appearing before the disciples. And then we assume all these things, which I see no reason to assume any of them. Blood in the water is enough evidence to show he was dead when his side was pierced. But then somehow he shows himself alive to the apostles, and they look and they say, you know something, Jesus? I'm looking at your battered, beaten, torn up body and your obvious need of medical attention, and I'm looking at you and I'm thinking, you just conquered death. And now I'm willing to die a horrible death knowing that I'll be in your presence because you've proven to me that you've conquered death. No, they're going to say, Jesus, we need to get you some medical attention real quick here. Okay? And they're not going to be willing to be, you know, thrown to wild beasts, be stoned to death, to be crucified, to be battered and scourged for him. He appeared to them in such a way that they saw, okay, he has conquered death. And now we can be willing to die for him. The wrong tomb theory, that the woman went to the wrong tomb, found it empty, and proclaimed him risen.
The garden area, it would have probably been well known.
Mm-hmm.
And she probably would have known that it was Joseph's garden. I don't think she was known.
Because
I mean, they put him in it.
Yeah, and you also have several women, too.
Right.
And the other factor, though, too, is if the woman went to the wrong tomb and the apostle went to the wrong tomb, you can guarantee the Jewish religious leaders had the incentive to go to the right tomb, even if they had to uncover every nearby tomb, produce the rotting corpse of Christ. But the fact of the matter is, even if you accepted the wrong tomb theory, which is highly speculative and really doesn't have any evidence to back it. It's all based upon a prejudice against the miraculous, against the supernatural. So it's not really any evidence for it. It's just a distaste for the miraculous. But the wrong tomb theory, even if you accept it, it doesn't explain the post-resurrection appearances. the experiences of the apostles where they sincerely believed that they had seen Jesus risen from the dead and were willing to die because of that. The apostles were not willing to die for an empty tomb. They looked at the empty tomb and they're thinking stuff like, yeah, maybe I wonder if somebody stole the body or
yeah,
whatever.
They did that in the gospel message too.
I mean,
why would they write that at first?
Yeah.
They didn't write, oh, he's risen. In fact, they didn't even know where he was.
Yeah, yep.
And you had the angels, you know, telling them, no, he's not here.
Yes. So
they have to question.
Yeah,
I was just thinking about if I was remember what Thomas said when they went to Jerusalem? Well, if we follow this far, he might as well die with him too.
Yeah, but then he went into hiding. He went into hiding and wasn't with Peter and John the night that Jesus was arrested. And then even after, for a whole week after Jesus had appeared to the other apostles, what he was basically saying was, look, if I'm going to trust in him, I'm going to trust in him 100%. And in other words, the apostles, we're not going to embark on a public ministry preaching the risen Christ based on the empty tomb. With just the empty tomb, they were not convinced he had risen. Now, you could make a case that John was convinced just based on the empty tomb and looking at the position of the grave clothes.
Well, that was before you could get died, because they were prepared to go, this is before Christ was crucified.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about, John chapter 12.
Yeah, but he was speaking even before he
died. Yeah, what I'm getting, the context of what I'm talking about is the apostles were not willing to publicly proclaim a risen Christ based on an empty tomb. And the wrong tomb theory says you have no post-resurrection appearances. You just have them going to the wrong tomb. They think the tomb is empty, and they go out preaching the resurrection. No. With just an empty tomb, wrong tomb or right tomb, the apostles didn't believe he was risen and weren't going to go out preaching.
I'm willing to believe, too, that I'm like, what you would say, I don't even think they believe in the resurrection before the resurrection.
Because
even in the gospel message, you see a lot of side notes that they're writing in. We didn't know that at the time, but this is what he was talking about.
And I would say, and they didn't even believe, I would put it this way, they didn't even believe in Jesus' death until his death occurred. But not only did they didn't even believe in his resurrection until after he appeared to them. So, I mean, even after he rose, even with the evidence of the empty tomb, even with the woman's testimony, it appears that the only one who believed at that point, with the empty tomb and the woman's testimony and the sighting of the grave clothes, it appears that John believed. But it seemed that with the other apostles, they needed to see for themselves. It seems like that, it's not that they were chauvinistic like their culture was, which wouldn't allow a lady's testimony in the court. I mean, it's pretty tough to accept the testimony of anybody. But Thomas couldn't even accept the testimony of the other 10 apostles. So it's kind of like, until I see this guy myself, I'm not going to believe. But it appears that only John, given the testimony of the woman, seeing the empty tomb himself, and then seeing the position of the grave clothes, which I think alludes to the Shroud of Turin, I think it was open like a cocoon because of the, basically that you could see that the only way the body is removed is the body disappears from it. And,
it wasn't just like an empty shell, rather.
Well, I see it like an empty shell, like open on the sides, but, because you got the cloth at the bottom here and then there. The spices would have hardened it enough and all to where it quite possibly would have remained in
not like a cocoon.
But just the fact that it was probably in such a way that John saw that nobody removed the body just disappeared, and but John looked and believed. And
I think they kept the shroud. He took it with him.
Yeah, but you're preaching primarily to Jews, and Jews are real anti-relics. And it appears, I'd have to go check my notes, it appears that, was it Jude Thaddeus who took it to King Agbar of Edessa, who had sent a note to Jesus, a letter to Jesus, asking for Jesus to come to him to heal him. And Jesus was basically saying that the time of his death was near, but that he would send someone later. And so one of the apostles went to him, and this was an ancient ancient Turkey, I believe Edessa is in, and brought to him Dr. Stuart McBurney did a real lot of it. Dr. Stuart McBurney wasn't even talking about the shroud. He's just dealing with Eusebius records this account, and there's more factors out in other places, and Stuart McBurney put it together, but brought with him a cloth, which the name for it meant like image not made with human hands, and somehow bearing the image of Christ, and the king was healed, and but it's one of those deals where you just leave it with the Gentiles. It's something the Gentiles could accept, but not the Jews, and that's where its history in Turkey begins. Then later on, it eventually fell into the hands of the Knights Templar and became known as the Mandilion, which was for centuries was thought to be a face cloth of Christ. But now the British historian and journalist Ian Wilson has shown, he's brought up medieval eyewitness accounts that the Mandilion at some time was folded in four, and sometimes it was unfolded to show the entire body of Christ, not just the miraculous face. So Ian Wilson shows the connection between all of them, and so we could trace the root of the, and then the pollen and the pollen on the Shroud of Turin traces its history to Jerusalem, to Turkey, and then eventually to Italy. And the flowers found, the images of the flowers on there tie it into not only to Jerusalem, because some of the plants only grow in the southern Jerusalem, Palestine area around the Dead Sea and Dead Sea area, but some of the flowers only grow during March and April in the Palestine area. It's the only place they grow in the world, and which is the Passover time. So, whatever the case, so the wrong tomb theory just you know, the Jews would have found the body if the apostles and the ladies went to the wrong tomb and paraded the rotting corpse of Christ and crushed Christianity in its embryo form. But even if we assume they went to the wrong tomb and the Jews didn't find the body, it wouldn't explain what the apostles still believed, believed to be the post-resurrection appearances of Christ. And that's what they were, that caused them to believe in the resurrection, and that's what they were sincere enough about to die for. So so the other alternative theory, naturalistic alternative explanation of the post-resurrection appearances of Christ, the resurrection accounts, the hallucination theory, Gary Habermas could probably, he wouldn't sell, but I'd buy a copy, but everybody at this table would buy a copy, but he could probably write an entire book on why the hallucination theory fails. But this probably has more plausibility than any other naturalistic theory, but it's been so thoroughly disproven that's why I said that New Testament critics or philosophers who've read New Testament critics will give you the core historical facts, but then won't come up with an alternative theory. And so then when you pin them down on it, rather than acknowledging Christ's resurrection, they'll usually throw out the hallucination theory. But they don't come, they're not really proponents of it. It's just a forced and temporary position to take. but it's so easy to refute. But the first problem is, okay, right here you see I have a bottle of water in front of me. And the reason why we all agree about that is because it's objective. It exists outside of our minds so that all four of us can experience it. We can see it, we can touch it, we can taste it. Okay? Now, if I was hallucinating and I looked at that and thought it was a red elephant, okay, you guys would say, no, it's a bottle of water. Okay? See, because a hallucination, by definition, is not based in objective reality. It's a subjective experience. A hallucination, by definition, occurs inside somebody's mind. Therefore, psychologists have determined no two people can share the same hallucination. Okay?
Much less multiple people.
Yeah, much less 12 apostles and then over 500 at one time. Nobody's going to call Paul a liar there. And it's an ancient creed. And so the hallucination theory doesn't hold much water at all. Habermas gets so advanced on this that he shows that people who hallucinate, suffer from like wishful thinking. They're in despair, but they desire something to be true, and then they hallucinate that it is true. So it is possible that your loved one dies or leaves you, and then you hallucinate that they came back and that you're talking with them, but it's not possible for more than one person to have that same hallucination. That's number one. But number two, the Jewish understanding, and Habermas and Craig have gone a long way on this, but it's widely acknowledged as well. The Jewish understanding, ancient Jewish understanding of resurrection, was a corporate resurrection, a resurrection of all Jews at the end times. They didn't understand the Old Testament hints about the Messiah being the first fruits of the resurrection. So they didn't see like one single person being raised to immortality alone. So it just was outside of their expectation. It just doesn't fit into it. Then also, people who have had hallucinations do not tend to transform a person's life in any way other than cause them to be more psychotic. Okay, so in other words, it's very unlikely that people are going to hallucinate and then it's going to further their cause based on that hallucination. So I mean the list goes on and modern psychological theories let me say this about the modern psychology. Most of it is rubbish.
Yeah.
Okay? Although, because most of it is rubbish, a lot of psychologists are rejecting traditional psychological theories and accepting human responsibility, accepting the concept of sin. So in some areas, they're moving back. But the areas, it's psychology as data drawn from observing human behavior and human thinking. You can get a lot of truth out of that. It's the conclusions that non-Christian psychologists draw from that data that it concerns me. But basically, by observing people who have had hallucinations, we can get a lot of data from modern psychology to show what a hallucination is, what type of people are likely to have it, what type of people are not likely to have it, you know, and the list goes on. Very rarely do you have a person who hallucinates who's willing to die for that hallucination. But whatever the case, hallucination theory has failed. You won't find many proponents of it. Because of this, because the liberal scholars have refuted their own theories, That's why you get a guy out of Southern California that William Lane Craig debated at UCLA. It was either UCLA or USC. He wrote his doctoral dissertation arguing that Jesus had a twin brother that nobody knew about. And after Jesus died, the twin brother coincidentally showed up in the Jerusalem area. The apostles thought it was Jesus, proclaimed him alive. His twin brother decided to go along with it, and then 40 days later split. Nobody saw him again. And now that's foolishness.
But,
yeah, and it's total foolishness. Yeah, it doesn't explain the wounds. Doesn't explain him appearing in the upper room. And it's kind of like coincidental that he just happened to
have...
He knows
everybody.
Yeah.
That's another thing. And why would he know these people by name?
Unless there's a racket going on.
Yeah.
And one of the twins got killed, which was supposed to happen. It was like, ooh.
So, and it's like, it's foolishness, but that's the kind of foolishness scholars are willing to accept rather than acknowledge that Jesus rose from the dead.